case number 20-1334, McKinney Jackson versus Genesee County Road Commission. Oral argument, 15 minutes to be shared by plaintiff and amicus, 15 minutes for the defendant. Mr. Bernard for the appellant.
Your Honors, may it please the court, Paul Bernard on behalf of plaintiff appellee McKinney Jackson. I reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. As we set forth in the brief, I think there's a few more principal questions about the court's decision. The first two pertain to Title VII, and they are whether the act involves enough evidence to create a jury question regarding young and the second is whether Ms. Jackson provided enough evidence to create a jury question regarding causation.
Bernard, we're having a few audio problems with you. Maybe you need to speak up a bit or turn the volume up.
Sorry about that, Your Honor.
You can suspend the time that's running right now, Marshall. Go ahead and proceed.
Okay. I've got my audio set at the maximum volume. I'll try to speak louder as well.
Okay. All right.
So the third issue is whether Ms. Jackson provided enough evidence to create a jury question on her state law claim under of retaliation under the Michigan Elliott Larson Civil Rights Act. Whether she provided enough evidence of causation to create a jury question on the public policy claim that she asserted. With regard to protected activity, Ms. Filo is going to address the issue of the so-called manager rule. If this court has any questions for me on that issue, I'll certainly be happy to address them, but I'm going to leave the substance of that argument to her. And I'm going to first talk about the district court's apparent understanding of the concept of opposition. Ms. Jackson claimed that she was retaliated against under the opposition clause. And the district court concluded that she didn't engage in protected activity under that clause because neither her supervisor, Mr. Daly, nor anybody else at the commission ever actively opposed her proposed reforms. The commission seems to take this. And I think that the question of whether the commission followed Ms. Jackson's recommendations or whether they thought her reforms was a good idea, I think that question is relevant to causation, particularly whether they have a legitimate non-discriminatory reason for discharge. But I don't think that question is relevant to whether she engaged in a protected activity, and specifically whether she opposed discrimination. Crawford and the cases that follow Crawford make it more than clear that opposition is opposition to discrimination generally, not opposition to your employer, and that various kinds of affirmative actions against discrimination and even passive resistance to discrimination all count. Ms. Jackson engaged in opposition in a couple of principal ways. First, by investigating long dormant allegations of discrimination by commission employees. She first investigated allegations of discrimination from multiple employees against Mr. Bennett, and she later investigated allegations of discrimination from Joyce McClain that were principally directed at another department director at the commission, Ms. Williams. In these investigations, Ms. Jackson undertook to determine whether discrimination had been taken place and to determine whether any responsive action was necessary. With respect to Mr. Bennett, despite the court's assessment of the evidence, she affirmatively and explicitly concluded that he engaged in discriminatory conduct, particularly towards Mr. Branch. In that connection, I think it's important to remember that when she was conducting the investigation of Mr. Bennett, Ms. Jackson, in association with that investigation, Ms. Jackson gave EEOC complaint forms to Mr. Branch, Ms. Ivy, and Ms. McClain, all of which indicate that those three employees had a serious concern about discrimination and that Ms. Jackson investigated that. So I think the question whether she engaged in opposition activity can be answered almost entirely with respect to the Bennett investigation. I think she also engaged in opposition activity with respect to the investigation of Ms. Williams. And although that investigation was eventually delegated to another aspect of county government because of a concern about conflicts, even the preliminary investigation that Ms. Jackson conducted was enough to count as opposition to discrimination. Finally, there's her action in seeking to assure that the commission's contractors were complying with the commission's own requirements that they have EEO plans in place. The EEOC and its guidance, and here I'm referring to the EEOC's enforcement guidance on retaliation related issues. In that guidance, the EEOC identifies advising an employer on EEO compliance as an example of opposition. So when Jackson is communicating with contractors about whether or not they have EEO plans in place, she's engaging in conduct that opposes discrimination. So for all of those reasons, I think she more than adequately established the question of protected activity. With respect to the prima facie case of causation, both the temporal proximity and other indicia of retaliatory conduct were established, and those were sufficient to create a jury question, to create a prima facie case of in particular, if you look at the Bennett investigation, she was discharged no more than 8 or 10 weeks after she finished dealing with Bennett. In fact, if you look at Mr. Guderian's testimony, he testifies that Daly decided to discharge her in mid-September, so that could be as little as 6 weeks after the Bennett investigation concluded. With respect to EEO plan compliance and the Williams investigation, both of those matters were ongoing right up until the time she was discharged, certainly no later than late September. So there is temporal proximity, and the most important factor relating to causation here involves the fact that the reasons for her discharge were tied to her protected activity. Specifically, the complaints from others that Daly identified as evidence of her abrasive communication style were all complaints that arose, or predominantly complaints that arose, out of her attempt to conduct investigations or enforce the EEO plan requirements. I see that I'm approaching the end of my time. So
yeah, I just have to ask you one question. Maybe you can answer pretty briefly. Would you address the issue of pretext? You haven't really spent
much
time on that. That's, quite frankly, the issue that most interests me in this case right now.
I think the question of pretext is, I think the most important factors with with respect to pretext is that Ms. Jackson had evidence to show that in fact, she wasn't abrasive in her communication style, because there was testimony from a variety of witnesses that they never found her to be abrasive. There was also evidence to show that the commission wasn't actually motivated by her communication style, because all of the reasons of the evidence that Daly cited, her communications with department heads like Mr. Pavandi and Mr. Plamondon, her communications with some of the contractors, those were important factors in Mr. Daly's decision, and they all related to Ms. Jackson's attempts to enforce the EEO plan requirements. If you look specifically at how those complainants discussed Ms. Jackson, they said she was too rigid because she was insisting on strict adherence to her EEO plan guidelines requirements. So all of those things contribute to pretext. And the commission argues that some of these requirements that Ms. Jackson imposed were nonsensical. But if, again, if you look at Mr. Daly's deposition testimony, look at the specific discussion of how the department directors or the contractors or others complained about Ms. Jackson, it was always, she's making us jump through too many hoops. She's making us follow too many procedures. This isn't the way we've done things before. And they characterize that as abrasive or rigid, but that could equally be characterized as enforcing the plan and opposing discrimination. And that's why we think there was a jury question on that.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Bernard. You'll have your rebuttal time. Ms. Philo?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court, Elisa Philo for the United States as amicus. Thank you, Your Honor. As Mr. Bernard mentioned, Ms. Jackson engaged in protected opposition when she informed her supervisor that she believed unlawful discrimination had occurred at the Road Commission. The district court erred when it required Ms. Jackson to show that she went beyond her job duties in order to be protected from retaliation. Indeed, this court has already rejected such a requirement in Johnson and should do so again here. Under Title VII, an employer is prohibited from discriminating against any employee who opposes conduct made unlawful by Title VII. The Supreme Court in Crawford confirmed that oppose has its plain meaning, which is expansive. It means to confront, contend against, withstand, or resist. And the Supreme Court made clear that if an employee communicates to her employer a belief that discrimination has occurred, that conduct virtually always constitutes opposition. And that is exactly what happened in this case when Ms. Jackson informed her employer, her supervisor, Mr. Daly, that one employee had discriminated against another employee. But the district court held that Ms. Jackson hadn't engaged in protected conduct because her opposition was within the course of her regular job duties. This doesn't follow either the text of Title VII or as it's been interpreted by the Supreme Court. Instead, this tracks another judicial creation for a different statute, the Fair Labor Standards Act. The Fair Labor Standards Act has its own anti-retaliation provision. It is narrower than Title VII's. Whereas Title VII prohibits retaliation against any employee who opposes discrimination, the FLSA only prohibits retaliation against employees who file a complaint. And the so-called manager rule is what courts have created to determine when an HR employee or a manager can be said to have filed a complaint under the FLSA.
Could you just hold up 1 second, Ms. Filer? I think we lost Judge Gibbons.
We did.
Sorry.
Deputy Foltz, can you please reset the clock to 3 minutes?
Yes.
I had to do the same thing I had to do yesterday.
We're back.
Excuse me. It was outside my control.
We understand.
I was kicked out.
Well, Ms. Philo, I think we suspended just about the time you lost the connection. So, Ms. Philo, you can continue.
Not a problem. I was just talking about the manager rule under the Fair Labor Standards Act and how it is a judicially created doctrine under the specific text of that statute, which is different in Title VII. And under that rule, managers and HR employees are required to step outside their job duties by taking action adverse to their employers to put their employers on notice that they are asserting their statutory rights. And regardless of this rule's viability under the Fair Labor Standards Act, it certainly cannot be imported into Title VII, given Title VII's text and precedent. And indeed, this court in Johnson rejected the manager rule in substance, if not by name. In Johnson, the plaintiff was a high-ranking affirmative action official at the university. And this court held that his actions in his role, complaining about some of the hiring decisions, constituted protected opposition. The court held that this was protected conduct irrespective of his contractual job duties. And the court held that to conclude otherwise would run against Title VII's broad remedial purpose. This court reaffirmed that holding a year later in the unpublished decision in Warren. And since then, two other circuits have joined this court in rejecting the manager rule. You have the Second Circuit rejecting the manager rule under Title VII in Little John. And then you have DeMasters, the Fourth Circuit rejected the manager rule under Title VII.
And what do you want the court to do here? To sit back down and let the district court make the correct finding, or what? Or can we do that?
Your Honor, what we're asking for is for you to confirm and clarify your holding in Johnson. We don't take a position on any of the other issues in this case, and we recognize that other issues do exist, as Mr. Bernard was discussing. But we think that although Johnson clearly holds in this case, there is lingering confusion, as evidenced by the district court's decision here and the district courts that it cited. And so we would ask this court to confirm that the manager rule has no place under Title VII. And under the correct analysis, Ms. Jackson engaged in opposition when she communicated her belief that discrimination had occurred, irrespective of her job duties. If the court has no further questions, we'll rest on the brief.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Badalamenti, if I've pronounced that correctly.
And thank you.
You may proceed.
Okay. So the important facet, I think, of the argument that's occurred so far in the briefing is this idea that there was this communication by Ms. Jackson to her employer. The reason why Mr. Bernard and Ms. Philo keep telling you that is because the opposition under Crawford that is required is an employee who communicates to her employer a belief that the employer is engaged in some form of discrimination. I agree, Your Honors, with Ms. Philo, that the manager rule is not established in the Sixth Circuit as to Title VII claims. However, opposition is not merely having an HR job. Opposition is not merely being involved in some way with investigating a personnel complaint. Opposition, by definition, under the Crawford United States Supreme Court ruling, is an employee that communicates that the employer is engaged in discrimination. So, what do we have here? Well, we have an employee who says that in her deposition at pages 109 and 110, that she concluded based on what Mr. Branch told her that Mr. Bennett was engaged in discrimination. The defect with what Mr. Bernard and Ms. Philo told you in their arguments is that Ms. Jackson never communicated that belief to her employer. On page 112 of her deposition, she indicates as clear as day that she made her conclusions, whatever they were, that subjective belief she then took into a meeting with Mr. Daly, and her exact words to Mr. Daly were that she believed that Mr. Bennett's conduct was, quote, erratic. And as a result of that, she recommended that Mr. Bennett undergo a psych evaluation. At no point ever in her testimony does Ms. Jackson indicate that she told her employer that she felt that Bennett was engaged in discrimination against anyone. That is essential to the arguments that is being made by Mr. Bernard and Ms. Philo, because that communication to the employer is a critical component of opposition activity. Now, that being so, we have a series of cases that do not adopt the manager rule. Nobody's making that argument, and I don't think that the district court said the manager rule applies. What the district court said is in the HR context, when you have an HR employee, you have to be careful. You have to really look, because you don't want to create a rule whereby every HR or EEO officer or employee whose job it is to write anti-discrimination policies and investigate personnel complaints, that person doesn't automatically have a Title VII right just because that is their job. No, you need actual opposition. And so the cases like Little John say, there absolutely is not a manager rule that applies in that context. However, the employee in the HR context or otherwise must actually do something. They must support or encourage another employee to make a complaint, or they must express critical views of the employer's discriminatory employment practices. This is well settled in this circuit too. The Petite case, Petite versus Stepping Stone, recognizes that in the HR context that we have to look beyond just what their standard job duties were. So this is not characterized as a question about whether or not Ms. Jackson was acting within or without or outside of her job duties. The question from the Johnson case and the Rosenthal versus National Beverage case, those cases confirm that's not the test. It's not about in or outside of your job duties. The test is, was there an action in opposition? Was there an action by this employee that goes beyond mere involvement in a personnel complaint? In this case, it is undisputed. Ms. Jackson's own testimony is unequivocal. There was no action by her in opposition. She actually investigated these complaints. She made recommendations. She never informed Mr. Daly or anyone else at the Road Commission that she felt that there was race discrimination or any other sort of discrimination. She described Mr. Bennett's conduct as erratic. She indicated she had no conclusions regarding Mrs. Williams because she was referring it to another county office because of her own conflict. She wanted them to come up with an independent opinion. She cannot, by the mere fact that she's the one doing the investigation, she cannot automatically have opposition activity. That HR employee rule is something that is established in the Title VII context. The Lewis Smith case establishes it in the Title VII context. The Coleman versus G4S Secure Eastern District case in 2016 recognizes, based on Lewis Smith, that the HR rule in fact does exist in the Title VII context. A plaintiff whose job it is to report and investigate discrimination claims does not automatically have a Title VII claim. You can't actually fire that person without them having some automatic right to file under Title VII. You can, though, still have an HR employee who has a Title VII claim. And that HR employee may very well have never stepped outside the box of their job duties. The question is, and it is one that must be examined, and I believe the district court examined correctly, is whether or not the investigation of complaints of discrimination included some action by that employee that could rise to the level of opposition. Opposition, by definition, is communication to the employer of a finding that there was discrimination, or supporting or encouraging the employee to file a complaint. That didn't happen here, neither one. It's undisputed in the record. I'm gonna repeat it again just to make sure. On page 112 of Ms. Jackson's deposition, she is unequivocal that whatever her subjective opinions were or her subjective conclusions even about what Mr. Branch felt regarding Mr. Bennett, that he was actually discriminating, that he'd actually made statements about the color of Mr. Branch's skin. The fact that that occurred was never communicated to Mr. Daly. That would have been opposition, I agree, even though it was within the course and scope of her job duties, but it didn't happen. That being so, to make sure that the Petite and the Coleman and the Lewis Smith HR rule exists, element two of a prima facie case of employment discrimination for Title VII requires knowledge on the part of the employer. In this situation, there was no knowledge. Ms. Jackson never indicated that she had concluded or made a finding that there had been discrimination going on either by Ms. Williams or by Mr. Bennett. And she never communicated that there was some discrimination issue or policy problem or vendor problem, or that the vendors were refusing to comply with the EEO requirements. She never communicated any of that to Mr. Daly. So that knowledge element, that's element two of the prima facie test for a Title VII case, is equally as important, and it's dispositive here. Element four in this case, and I respect that, Justice Cole, you indicated that this is where your focus is. The causal connection is important in this case, and it's something that I think it's sort of glossed over in the briefs of the appellant. The appellant suggests that there is, that for the first time, that there is direct evidence of retaliation in this case. There's just direct evidence of discrimination. There is not. The argument is that Mr. Daly's decision that, or conclusion that Ms. Jackson had an adversarial nature about her, that her tone was not productive, that she had upset several employees, that she could not get along with union officials and attorneys, that vendors' payments were being held up because she was stepping outside of her job responsibilities and actually putting check holds for vendors who didn't address her as Director Jackson or did not type out their responses to her as opposed to write them down. She indicates that subjective decision on his part that what she was doing was an abrasive communication style is absolutely direct evidence that that he was actually discriminating against her. And she cites Yazdian for that theory, but Yazdian doesn't involve that. Yazdian is an actual case where at the time of the termination, the supervisor indicated to the employee that the employee was being, it was a hostile work environment claim and the discharge was based on insubordination. The basis for the insubordination was the employee a few weeks before had told the employer that that she felt he was creating a hostile work environment and that some of his statements were racially charged. That was then used as the insubordination reason for the termination. That's a very different case from this one. This is a case where the testimony is pretty darn clear. Even those who actually appreciated Ms. Jackson's way of really addressing things head on and being very confrontational acknowledge that there were a lot of people at the Road Commission who were very put off by her, who did not want to go to HR for any reason. They had a big problem with her abrasive style and acknowledged that Mr. Daly had received numerous complaints. It was very well known within the commission. So it's not like it wasn't happening or it was some subjective thing he came up with off the cuff.
Well, counsel, wasn't there evidence to the contrary though? As I understand Mr. Dickerson's deposition, he says that he never heard any complaints about Jackson. And that 2 weeks before termination, he was told by Daly that Jackson was doing a great job. Latimer, who was the lead supervisor and union member, said he had a great working relationship with Jackson, never had any concerns or complaints about her, nor that she had an abrasive or corrosive communication style. Mullen seems to have sort of been a little bit of both, a little bothered by tone, but said she did a good job. And then Branch, who was the head of the largest department, said he was satisfied with her. But especially Dickerson's deposition testimony, it just seems that there's evidence going both ways. And this is a classic situation where it's a disputed issue that should go to the jury.
Yeah, so I think you're right. And I think, in fact, even if you look at Mr. Daly's deposition, you'll hear or you'll read that Mr. Daly really liked Ms. Jackson. He thought she could really get things done. And he liked that. And so, when he counseled her several times about her aggressive communication style in hopes of kind of curbing that. And when she was able to negotiate a severance with Bennett, he actually praised her, even though she went outside his authority, the number that she was allowed to negotiate, he still praised her because it showed that she really had this other side of being able to kind of tone it down a little bit and work with people. And so I think that kind of the consensus is there were some people who found it to be very effective, but there were others who were very put off by it.
Mr. Daly, if we are to accept this as, you know, admissible testimony. According to Dickerson, Mr. Daly said to Dickerson 2 weeks before the decision was made to terminate Jackson, if I'm right, tell me if I'm wrong, that Jackson is doing a great job. You would think if Mr. Daly had problems, they were as serious as he believed them to be, that would result in termination 2 weeks later, that he would have said, oh, she did a great job with the settlement with Mr. Bennett and a couple of other things, but she's got the place in turmoil and people aren't getting along with her and is not doing a great job. I mean, I'm just wondering if that's just not a classic jury question.
Yeah, so that's what I was getting at is there is this this rift in people who really appreciate it and people who don't. What is very significant is number one, that Ms. Jackson doesn't dispute that those counseling sessions happened, that Mr. Daly had tried to curb the aggressive tone, the monolithic type of management. He had talked to her several times about it being a problem. She admits that in her testimony. But more importantly, in those 2 weeks, what actually occurs is Ms. Jackson walks over to the finance and payroll departments, and she actually puts a placehold or hold on a payment to a vendor. She's upset with this vendor, and she actually holds up the payment. That vendor then calls Mr. Daly. When that vendor called Mr. Daly, the secretary was crying. It was a whole to-do. Mr. Daly went and met with this vendor, figured out, got to the bottom of that story, and made the decision at that point that, you know, this wasn't getting, this monolithic, aggressive type of management and the tone and the attitude that Ms. Jackson approached issues with was not getting better with his counseling and his efforts, that in fact, it was getting worse. And it had gotten to a point where she had actually walked over and felt like she had the authority to hold payments, which was totally outside of her job scope and responsibilities.
Yeah, I guess my point, and you know, we can, you know, hear from Mr. Bernard again as well, is, you know, given that evidence and some other evidence, whether the reason that was given is really the reason for the termination. I understand that this employer, there seemed to be a lot of turmoil, and Ms. Jackson came in and there was, you know, it's like the vendors didn't like having to spend time dealing with the EEO policies, slowed things down. You had these two guys, Pevianda and Palamandan, I think, who, you know, wanted things to move quickly and get these bids placed. And she was sort of, in their view, slowing things down, requesting, changes to language. I guess my point just goes to the, you know, the prongs of pretext and whether this is really the reason. And it just seems that a strong argument can be made that there are disputes of fact that as to why she was terminated.
Well, so let me just address that, Judge.
If you do it briefly, because we are out of time, maybe 30 seconds.
So the way that you can use that evidence to address it in a pretext context is only one way, and that's the first rule, the first option, the first prong of a pretext analysis, and that is to show that there is no basis in fact. Not that there are maybe some other employees who felt differently, no basis in fact. And so the only way that you get to use that as a pretext argument is if you can say, no, that just came up at the end of everything. There had never been any counseling. He just came up with this as a reason after he terminated her. So there's no basis in fact. That's not what's going on here. Ms. Jackson acknowledged throughout that she had these issues. She acknowledged throughout that she was becoming more aggressive. And in fact, she said, if Mr. Dedarian wants to have it out with me, tell him to come by. She was very much aware of the fact that Mr. Daly wanted her to dial it down, and that her decision instead was to disregard his counseling efforts and to become more aggressive and even step out of her lane in an effort to become more aggressive. And okay. So I think that you can't show pretext by having questions of fact. You have to meet that burden shifting standard, which is to say no basis in fact for the reason that's given.
Okay, great. Thank you. Mr. Bernard, you're on mute again.
Oh, how's that?
Okay, no problem.
The first thing I want to address is the legal standard for finding opposition. And I have to say, with all due respect, that I think Ms. Battlementi just gets that wrong. She insists that the plaintiff has to take, has to show that the plaintiff took action and that the plaintiff actively opposed something that the employer was doing. And there's just nothing like that in Crawford. In fact, in Crawford, the protected conduct was an employee who merely responded to an employer's question, questions about what the discrimination was happening in the workplace. I mean, that's precisely the sort of passive conduct that Crawford specifically identifies as protected. Ms. Battlementi also talks about the Pettit case as a particularly example of why HR employees must go outside the scope of their job duties. But that's a Fair Labor Standards Act case. It's not a Title VII case, and for all the reasons that Ms. Feinel laid out, it's not determinative here. The second thing I want to address is the question of the commission's knowledge. I think it's important to point out, as we know in the brief, the commission had extensive notice about the discrimination complaints against Bennett by Branch and others before Ms. Jackson was ever even hired. One of the reasons that she addressed Bennett's situation first was because there had been these longstanding complaints of discrimination that had been presented daily and nothing had been done about it. And she was, you know, her first order of business was to investigate those discrimination complaints. So certainly I don't think there can be any question about knowledge. And the last thing I want to address relates to pretext. In the Yazdian case, it notes that when the proffered legitimate non-discriminatory reason is subjective, that automatically creates a jury question. And here, the subjective reason was people don't like her manner. There are people who, as your Judge Cole, as you pointed out, there are people in the commission who didn't agree with that. And I think Ms. Battlementi effectively concedes that there was a jury question about this. There's conflicting evidence about this. And if there is, if there's conflicting evidence about that subjective reason, there's a jury question on causation.
Okay. I don't think we have any more questions. So, counsel, I thank you, all the three of you, for your arguments this afternoon. We very much appreciate them. We'll take the case under advisement.